Chapter 5. Three more uniformed bobbies had been drafted in to help keep the channel crews back from the police station gate. Ribbons of sweat stained the spines of their white shirts as they shouted and pushed at the incursive horde. Eleanor drove out into the road and turned hard right, heading down towards the railway station. The way to do it, she discovered, was imagine the road to be empty and just go. Reporters and camera operators nipped out of the way, sharpish. She had been right about them tracking down Greg's personal data profile, though. "Mr. Mandel, is it true you're helping the police with a Kitchener murder?" "You don't farm sheep, Greg. What are you here for?"
"Did Julia Evans send you?"
"Is it true you used to serve in MindStar? Eleanor, where are you going?"
"Come on, Greg, say something."
"Can we have a statement?" She passed the last of them level with the fast food caravans and pressed her foot down. The hectic shouts faded away. A smell of fried onions and spicy meat blew into the EMC Ranger through the dashboard vents.
"Christ," she murmured.
When she lived on the kibbutz, she had often accompanied her father and the other men when they took the hounds out hunting. She had seen what happened to foxes, wild cats, and even other dogs when the hounds ran them down. They would keep on worrying the bloody carcass until there was nothing left but shreds. The press, she reflected sagely, had an identical behaviour pattern. For the first time, she began to feel sorry for Langley, having to conduct his inquiry with them braying relentlessly on his heels. If she had known about them as well as the way the police would treat her and Greg, she might well have played the part of the shrewish wife and told him no. Too late now. A quick check in the rearview mirror showed her the police panda car carrying Vernon Langley and John Nevin was following them. Langley had assigned Amanda Patterson to accompany her and Greg in the EMC Ranger. Eleanor wasn't quite sure who was supposed to be chastised by the arrangement. Amanda was sitting in the rear of the big car, hands folded across her lap, a sullen expression on her face as she watched the detached houses of Station Road whiz past. So defensive, Eleanor thought, as if the Kitchener inquiry were some shabby secret she was guarding. And now the barbarians were hammering on the gate, demanding access.
"You okay?" Greg asked.
"Sure." He held her gaze for a moment.
"How about you, Amanda?" he asked.
Startled, the woman looked up.
"Yes, fine, thank you."
"Have they been like that the whole time?" Eleanor asked her.
"Yes," she paused. "It hasn't helped when we went round the villages collecting statements. They often got the residents' stories before we did." Her mouth tightened. "They shouldn't have done that."
Eleanor drove over the level crossing and took the Braunston Road. The clouds were darkening overhead, a uniform neutral veil. It would rain soon, she knew. A thunderstorm. Weather sense was something everybody cultivated these days. Greg inclined his head fractionally towards her, then flipped open his cyberfax and started to run through the statements he'd loaded into the memory. Grey-green data trundled down the small LCD screen, rearranging itself each time he muttered an instruction. Devious man, she thought, holding back a smile. Among his other qualities. She could read him so easily, something she'd been able to do right from the start. And vice versa, of course, him with his gland. Greg always said she had psychic traits, although he didn't want her to take the psi assessment tests. Not putting his foot down, they didn't have that kind of relationship, but heavily opposed to her having a gland. He was more protective about it than anything else, wanting to spare her the ordeal. Several MindStar veterans had proved incapable of making the psychological adjustment necessary to cope with their expanded psi ability. There were so few people who saw that aspect of Greg, his concern, the oh-so-human failings. Gland prejudice was too strong, an undiluted paranoia virus. Nobody saw past the warlock power. They were dazzled by it. Countless times she had watched people flinch when they were introduced to him, and she could never decide quite why. Perhaps it was all the time he'd spent in the army in the Trinities. He had the air of someone terribly intimate with violence. Not an obvious bruiser type, like those idiots Andrew Foster and Frankie Owen. More like the calm reserve martial arts experts possessed. The first time they met, the day she ran away from the kibbutz, her father had come looking for her. He backed down so fast when Greg intervened. It was the first time she had ever seen her father give way over anything. He always had God's righteousness on his side, so he claimed. More like incurable peasant obstinacy, she thought. The cantankerous old Bible thumper. The whole of her life until then, or so it seemed, had been filled with his impassioned skeletal face, craning out of the pulpit in the wooden chapel, broken purple capillaries on his rough cheeks, showing up tobacco brown in the pale light which filtered through the turquoise glass window behind the altar. That face would harangue and cajole even in her dreams, promising God's justice would pursue her always. But all it had taken was a few quiet-spoken, resolute words from Greg, and he had retreated, walking out of her life for good. Him, the kibbutz's spiritual leader, abandoning his only daughter to one of Satan's technological corruptions. She had moved into Greg's chalet that night. The two of them had been together ever since. The other residents at the Berrybud timeshare estate warned her that Greg could be moody, but it never manifested with her. She could sense when he was down, when he needed sympathy, when he needed to be left alone. Those long anarchistic years in the Trinities, the cheapness of life on Peterborough's streets, were bound to affect him. He needed time to recover, that was all. Couldn't people see that? She always felt sorry for couples who were unable to plug into each other's basic emotions. They didn't know what they were missing. She'd never trusted anyone quite like she did Greg. That and the sex, of course.
Kitchener was fairly rich, wasn't he? She asked Amanda.
Yes, he had several patents bringing in royalties. His molecular interaction equations all had commercial applications, crystals and wear chips, that kind of thing. It was mostly combatants who took out licenses. They paid him a couple of million new sterling a year.
Eleanor let out an impressed whistle.
Who stands to inherit?
Amanda's features were briefly illuminated with a recalcitrant grin when she realized how smoothly they had breached her guard.
We examined that angle. Nor one person benefits. Kitchener had no immediate family. The closest are a couple of younger cousins, twice removed. He left a million new sterling to their children. There are seven of them, so split between them it doesn't come to that much. The money goes into a trust fund anyway, and they're limited to how much can be withdrawn each year. But the bulk of the estate goes to Cambridge University. It will be used for science scholarships to enable underprivileged students to go to the university, and funding two of the physics faculties, with the proviso that it's only to be spent on laboratory equipment. He didn't want the dons to feather their nests with it.
What about Launde Abbey? Who gets that?
The university. It's to be a holiday retreat for the most promising physics students. He wanted them to have somewhere they could go to escape the pressure of exams and college life, just sit and think. It's all in his will.
That doesn't sound like the Edward Kitchener we hear about, Eleanor observed.
That was his public image, Amanda said. Once you've talked to the students, you'll find out that it really was mostly image. They all worshipped him.
The EMC Rangers started up the hill, which led out of town. A new housing estate was under construction on both sides of the road, the first in Oakham for 15 years. The houses had a pre-warming Mediterranean look, thick, white-painted walls to keep out the heat, silvered windows, solar cell panel roofs made to look like red clay tiles, broad overhanging eaves. And garages, she noted. The architects must share a confidence about the future.
She had been relieved when the council passed the planning application. Considering all they'd been through when they lost their homes and the cramped conditions of the school campus, the Fens refugees deserved somewhere for themselves. After the economy started to pick up, she had worried they would develop into a permanent underclass, resentful and resented. A lot of them had actually been employed to build the houses, but despite that and the cacao plantations, the numbers of unemployed in the Oakham district was still too large. The town urgently needed more factories to bring jobs into the area. The transport network wasn't up to supporting commuters yet, allowing people to work in the cities like they used to. She often wondered if she should ask Julia to establish an event horizon division in the industrial estate. Would that be an abuse of privilege? Julia could be overbearingly generous to her friends. And there were a lot of towns which needed jobs just as badly as Oakham. Of course, if the Event Horizon factory had to be built anyway, why not use what influence she had? At the moment, she was just waiting to see if the council development officers could do what they were paid to, and attract industrial investment. If they hadn't interested a combinate after another 6 months or so,
she probably would have a word. A favour for a favour, she thought. Because God knows this Kitchener case is tougher than either of us expected. Julia would have to site a whole cyber precinct next to the town to be quits. She took the West Road out of Braunston. It was a long, straight stretch up the recently replanted Cheseldine Spinney. The turning down to Launde Park was 500 metres past the end of the tan-bark oak saplings. There was a row of yellow police cones blocking it off, tire deflation spikes jutting out of their bases like chrome-plated rhino horns. One of Oakham's panda cars, with two uniformed constables inside, was on duty in front of them. Eleanor counted 10 reporters camped opposite, their cars parked on the thistle-tangled verge. As soon as the EMC Ranger stopped by the panda car, the reporters were up and running. Cyberfaxes, switched to AV record, were pressed against the glass like rectangular slate-grey leeches. Amanda pulled out her police-issue cyberfax and used its secure link to talk to the bobbies in the panda car. Eleanor saw one of them nod his head languidly. Then they both climbed out and walked towards the cones.
"Are you taking over the case from the police, Mr. Mandel? Is it true the Prime Minister appointed you to the investigation?
Are you Julia Evans' lover, Greg?"
Eleanor refused to snap the retort which had formed so temptingly in her mind. Instead, she forced a contemptuous smile, thinking how good it would feel to stuff that tabloid channel reporter's cyberfax where the sun didn't shine. The bobbies finished clearing away the cones and waved Eleanor on. They could have cleared them away before we arrived, she thought. Perhaps it's part of the needling, making us run the press gauntlet. The Chater Valley was a lush, all-over green, the steep walls bulging in and out to form irregular glens and hummocks. Dead hawthorn hedges acted as trellises for ivy-leaf pelargoniums, heavy with hemispherical clusters of cerise pink flowers. The fields were all given over to grazing land, although there was no sign of any animals. The permanent grass cover helped to prevent soil erosion in the monsoon season. As they moved over the brow on the northern side, she began to appreciate how secluded the valley was. There had been no clue of its existence from the road out of Braunston. They started to go down a slope with a vicious incline. The road was reduced to two strips of tarmac just wide enough for the EMC Ranger's tyres, speed wells forming a spongy strip between them. Tiny blue and white flowers closed against the darkening sky. Trickles of water were running out of the verges, filling the tarmac ruts. Eleanor slowed down to a crawl.
"Mr. Mandel,"
Amanda said. There was such a sheepish tone to her voice, Eleanor actually risked glancing from the road to check her in the mirror. Greg looked back over his shoulder.
"What is it?"
"There was something else we didn't release to the press," Amanda said. "Kitchener had a lightwear number cruncher at the Abbey. He used it for numerical simulation work. Its memory core was wiped. I didn't think about it until you mentioned Event Horizon's involvement. Whatever Kitchener was working on, it's lost for good now."
"No messing," Greg said.
He sounded almost cheerful.
"We weren't sure if the wear had been knocked out by the storm or something. We didn't really connect the two events. But if you take commercial sabotage as a motive for the murder, then it was probably deliberate."
"Do you know when the core was wiped?" Greg asked. "Before Kitchener was murdered? After? During?"
"No, I've no idea."
"What did the students say?"
"I don't know. I can't remember if they were asked."
Greg thought for a moment, then started defining a search program that would run through the statements stored in his cyberfax. Eleanor heard Amanda doing the same thing. That was when they reached a really steep part of the road, just above the Chater itself. She put the EMC Ranger into bottom gear and kept her foot on the brake pedal. The water channeled by the ruts was running a couple of centimetres deep around the tyres.
"Are you sure about the bridge?" she asked Amanda. "It should be passable by now. There was only a 5-centimetre fall last night." "You mean you don't know?"
There was a bend at the foot of the slope. Eleanor nudged the EMC range around it, dreading what she'd see. Turning round here would be difficult. Right at the bottom of the valley, the river had worn a cramped, narrow gully in the earth. The scarp had been scoured of grass and weeds by the recent monsoon floods, leaving a pockmarked face of raw, red-brown earth. Ahead of the EMC Ranger, the road had miraculously reappeared in full. Grass, moss, nettles and speedwells swept away by the water. The panda car was holding back. She caught a glimpse of it on top of the final slope. Waiting for us to find out what the river is like, she thought. Bastards.
We're waterproof, remember? Greg said. He winked.
She grinned savagely and urged the EMC Ranger along the last 10 meters to the bridge. The Chater was a turbulent slash of fast-flowing brown water boiling over the bridge. Eleanor used the white handrail as a guide as she gingerly steered over it. Water churned around the wheels. She estimated it was about 15 centimeters deep, not even up to the axle. Once they were over the river, the road turned right. Greg pulled at his lower lip, looking back thoughtfully. The smaller panda car was edging out over the bridge, water up to the base of its doors.
Tell you, John Nevin was right. Nothing would have got over that on Thursday night and Friday morning, Greg said.
There was a lake ahead of them, a rectangle 50 meters long, draining into the Chater through a crumbling concrete channel. A small earth bank rose up behind it, sprouting dead horse chestnut trees, which were leaning at precarious angles. They started to climb up the slope, a dreary expanse of scrimpy, slightly yellowed grass. The road surface on this side of the Chater was even worse than the northern side. Past the end of the first lake, and 10 meters higher, was a second, a triangular shape, 100 meters along each side. It was being fed by a waterfall at the head. A decrepit wooden fence slimed with yellow-green lichen ran round it.
"Stop here," Greg said.
Eleanor pulled up level with the end of the lake. She guessed there was another above them. Greg opened the door and got out, standing in front of the bonnet, staring at the lake. His eyes had that distant look, the gland neurohormones unplugging him from the physical universe.
"A world sculpted from shadows," he'd said once,
when he tried to describe the way neurohormones altered his perception.
"Similar to a photon amp image, everything dusty and grainy, but translucent. You could see right through the planet if you had enough strength. The shadows are analogous to the fabric of the real world. Houses, machinery, furniture, the ground, people. But not always. There are differences. Additions. Memories of objects. Phantasms, I suppose. And I can perceive minds, too. Separate from the body. Minds glow, like nebulas with a supergiant star hidden at the core."
The remoteness faded from his face. He gave the lake a last look, fingers stroking his chin, a faintly puzzled expression pulling at his features.
"What did you see?" she asked as he got back into the passenger seat.
His intuition was almost as strong as his empathy. When they first looked round the farmhouse on the Hambleton Peninsula, he had suddenly grabbed hold of her as she walked into one of the small upstairs bedrooms. He couldn't give a reason, just that she shouldn't go in. When they gave it a thorough examination, they found that a whole section of the floorboards in front of the door was riddled with woodworm. If she had just marched in, she would have fallen straight through.
"Not sure," Greg said.
The panda car was lumbering up the road behind them. Eleanor started off towards the third lake. The first tiny spots of drizzle began to graze the windscreen.
"A microlite landing spot?" she asked.
"No."
Amanda was giving them a slightly bemused look from the back seat. The third lake was a slightly larger version of the second. She could see the ruins of a small brick building situated halfway up the earth bank on the far side. She thought it might be an ancient ice house. A flock of Canada geese were grazing round the thick tufts of reedy grass which flourished around the shore.
"I'm sure I remember reading something else about Launde Abbey," Greg said. "Or maybe it was on a Channel newscast."
"I can't remember anything," Eleanor said.
"It was a few years ago, I think. 7 or 8, maybe more."
He didn't sound very convinced.
"What about you, Amanda? Have there been any other incidents up here?"
"No, not that I can recall." "What sort of incident?" Eleanor asked.
He gave her an abashed grin.
"Can't remember. Definitely something newsworthy, though."
"And it's connected to the Kitchener murder?" she asked.
"Lord knows. I doubt it. Not that long ago."
Launde Abbey was another 150 meters past the third lake, set in a broad, curving basin that seemed to have been chiselled into the side of the valley. A wooden fence marked the boundary of the parkland. The EMC Ranger rattled over a cattle grid, and the grass magically reverted to a shaggy, verdant green. Large black tree stumps were scattered about, each one accompanied by a new sapling.
Cory pines, giant chinkapins, torreyas, healthy replacements that relish the heat, turning the park back to its original rural splendour. Tarmac reappeared under the tyres. Eleanor turned off the road, which disappeared over the brow of the basin, and drove down the loop of drive to the abbey. She was somewhat disappointed with what she saw. She'd been expecting some great medieval monastery, all turrets and flying buttresses. Reality was a three-story Elizabethan manor house, built from ochre stone, with a broad frontage and projecting wings. The roof of grey-blue slate was broken by five gables, a row of solar panels capping the apex. There were two sets of chimney stacks, one on each wing. Three cream-white globes were perched amid the southern wing stacks, weather coverings for the satellite dishes. Climbing roses scrambled over the stonework around the porch, scarlet and yellow blooms dropping from the weight of water they had absorbed, petals mouldering. It backed onto a copse of high, straggly pines, most of which had survived the warming, their depleted ranks supplemented by some new banyan trees. Two unmarked white vans and a panda car were parked outside, belonging to the police crime scene team, which had been combing the abbey for clues since Friday. Eleanor drew up behind them. It was raining steadily, and they made a dash for the porch. A constable was waiting just inside. He saw Amanda and waved them all through. The interior was vaguely shabby, putting Eleanor in mind of a grand family fallen on hard times. The elegance still existed, in the furnishings and decor. The staircase looked exquisite, but it had been almost neglected. Clean, but not polished. Vernon Langley and John Nevin came in, shaking the rain from their jackets. Langley took a breath.
"I forgot to mention it before, Mandel," he said, "but the Abbey's lightwear memory core has been wiped."
"So Amanda told me," Greg said dryly.
Eleanor kept her grin to herself. One to the good guys.
"I see." He straightened his jacket. "Well, we've set up shop in the dining room if you'd like to come through."
There was very little of the dining room table left visible. At one end, the forensic team had set out their equipment, a couple of Philips laptop terminals and various boxy ware modules, which Eleanor guessed were analyzers of some kind, although one looked remarkably like a microwave oven. The rest of the table, about three quarters, was covered in sealed polythene sample bags. She could see clothes, shoes, books, hologram cubes, a lot of kitchen knives, glasses, Memox crystals, small porcelain dishes, candlesticks, even an old wind-up type clock. Some of them looked completely empty. Dust or hair, she thought. She was still puzzling over why they'd want to seal up a potted cactus when Vernon Langley introduced Nicolette Hutchins and Denzel Osborne, a pair of forensic investigators who had stayed on to continue the in-situ examination. They had been drafted in from Leicestershire, part of a 10-strong team which the Home Office had ordered to the Abbey. Both of them were wearing standard blue police one-piece overalls. Nicolette Hutchins was in her 40s, a small woman with a narrow, slightly worn face, her dark hair wrapped in a tight bun. She glanced up from one of the modules she was engrossed with and held out her hands. "Excuse me for not shaking." She was wearing surgeon's gloves. Denzel Osborne had the kind of build Eleanor associated with ex-professional sportsmen, muscle bulk which was starting to round out and sag. He must have been in his late 50s, with a flat, craggy face and receding blonde hair tied into a ponytail. He had a near-permanent smile, showing off three gold teeth, a flashy anachronism. He shook Greg's hand warmly, then his smile broadened even wider when he took Eleanor's.
"And I'm very pleased to meet you."
The play-acting made her grin. His genuine welcome was a refreshing change from the rest of the investigating team.
"So you were in the Mindstar Brigade, were you?"
Denzel asked Greg.
"Yeah."
"I was in Turkey, Royal Engineers. Worked with a Mindstar lieutenant called Roger Hales."
Greg smiled.
"Springer."
"That's right. We called him Springer because it didn't matter what kind of booby trap the Legion left behind. Roger could always spot it and trip it,"
Greg explained to Eleanor.
"He had one of the best bloody short-range perceptive faculties in the outfit."
"Saved my arse enough times," Denzel said. "Those mullahs were getting plenty tricky towards the end of that campaign."
"No messing," Greg said.
"I was chuffed when I heard they were bringing you in. Our Nicolette here doesn't believe what you blokes can do."
"I do believe," she said, not looking up from the analyzer module. "I just got bored with hearing about it day in, day out.
You'd think Turkey lasted for a decade the number of stories you tell.
Well, don't worry. Greg won't bore you today, Denzel said. Far from it. Today is the day when this investigation gets moving again, right, Greg?
Do my best.
You need something to fixate on?
No. I need data.
Denzel's eyebrows went up appreciatively.
Intuitionist?
Yeah.
Okay. What do you want to start with?
The security system, Eleanor said.
No problems with that, Denzel answered. It's all top-grade gear, fully functional.
Could an intruder melt through it and then back out again without leaving a trace?
Greg asked.
Hell no. It's built by Event Horizon, a customized job. Low-light photon amps, windows wired, internal motion sensors, IR plus UV laser scan. Unless your identity and three-dimensional image is loaded in the memory core, you couldn't move a millimeter inside the building without the alarm screaming for help. And it's got a secure independent uplink to Event Horizon's private communications satellite network, as well as the English Telecom West Europe Geosync platform.
Why?
You think somebody got in here?
Possibly, said Greg.
He explained his theory about the microlight, then went on to the contract Kitchener had been given with Event Horizon. When he had finished, even Nicolette Hutchins had abandoned her analyzer module to listen.
That adds some unusual angles to our problem, she said with morbid interest. Nobody was thinking along those lines when we arrived. We all thought it was a murder, not an assassination. And it's too late to look for signs of a microlight landing now. There have been 3 heaviest rainfalls since Thursday night's storm. They would have washed the valley clean.
Ever the optimist, Denzel retorted.
She shrugged and returned to her LCD display.
Hell, Greg, I don't know about a tech merc penetration, Denzel said. If it happened that way, then the software they used against the security core must have been premier grade. I wouldn't even know how to start writing it.
Eleanor exchanged a knowing glance with Greg.
Let me have what details you have on the system, she said. We know someone who can tell us if it's possible to burn in.
Vernon Langley would clearly have liked to ask who, but she just gave him her best enigmatic smile as Denzel typed an access request on his Philips laptop.
Here we are, he said. Complete schematics, right down to individual wear chips, plus the layout.
Eleanor held up her cyberfax and let him squirt the data package over.
I think the murder scene next, Greg said.
Eleanor didn't know about Greg, but she was picking up bad vibes from the minute they walked into Kitchener's bedroom. Apart from the furniture and Chinese carpet, it had been stripped clean. There were no ornaments or clothes. The occupier's stamp of personality had been voided. There were some funny patches on the carpet close to the door, as though someone had spilt a weak bleach on it, discoloring the weave. Adhesive tags with printed barcodes labelled each one. More tags were stuck over the table in the dresser. The tall freestanding mirror was completely swathed in polythene. The curtains had been taken down. Rain was beating on the window, unnaturally loud to her ears. And it was warm. She saw the air conditioner had been dismantled, its components scattered over a thick polythene sheet in one corner.
We wanted the dust filter, Denzel said absently. Surprising what they accumulate.
Langley and Nevin had followed her in. Amanda had stayed with Nicolette in the dining room.
I've seen it enough times, she'd muttered tightly.
Eleanor looked at the 4-poster bed and grimaced. The sheets had been removed. There was a big dark brown stain on the mattress. 3 holographic projectors had been rigged up around the bed. Chrome silver posts, 2 meters high, with a crystal bulb on top. Optical cables snaked over the floor between them. The player was lying on the carpet at the foot of the bed. Denzel picked it up and gave her an anxious glance. There was no sign of his smile.
Standard speech, but it really isn't pretty.
I'll manage, she said.
All right. But if you're going to vomit, do it out in the corridor, please. We've cleaned enough of it off this carpet already.
She realized he wasn't joking. An egg-shaped patch of air above the bed sparkled. Then the haze spread out silently. Runnels dripped down the side of the mattress onto the floor, serpents twisting up the carved posts. Edward Kitchener materialized on white silk sheets. The remains of Edward Kitchener. Eleanor grunted in shock and jammed her eyes shut. She took a couple of breaths. Come on, girl. You see far worse on any schlock horror channel show.
but that wasn't real. The second time it wasn't quite so bad. She was incredulous rather than revolted. What sort of person could calmly do this to another? And it had to be a deliberate, planned action. There was no frenzied hacking. It had to be performed with clinical precision. A necromantic operation. Hadn't the Victorian police suspected that Jack the Ripper was some kind of medical student? She glanced round. Greg had wrinkled his face up in extreme distaste, forcing himself to study the hologram in detail. John Nevin was looking at the floor, the window, the dresser, anywhere but the bed.
"Yeah, okay," Greg said. "That's enough."
The faint aural glow cast by the projection faded from the walls. When she looked back at the bed, Kitchener had gone. Air hissed out through her teeth, muscles loosening. Edward Kitchener had looked like such a chirpy old man, a sort of idealized grandfather, a gruff tongue and a loving nature.
"How was he actually killed?" Greg asked.
"We think he was smothered by a pillow," Vernon said. "One of them had traces of saliva in a pattern consistent with it being held over his head."
"So what did all the damage?"
"Pathology says a heavy knife," said Denzel. "Straight blade, 30 to 40 centimeters long."
"One of the kitchen knives?"
"We don't know. There are drawers full of them downstairs. Some of them are virtually antiques. We catalogued 18, and none of those had any traces of blood. But the housekeeper can't say for sure if one is missing. And then there's all the lab equipment, plus the engineering shop, plenty of cutting implements in those two. Blimey, you could make a knife in the engineering shop, then grind it up afterwards. Who knows?" Greg led them all back out into the corridor.
"Did the murderer leave any traces?"
"The only hair and sink particles we have found anywhere in the bedroom belong to either Kitchener, the students, or the housekeeper and her two helpers."
"What about when the murderer left?" Greg asked. "Do you know the route they took? There must have been some of Kitchener's blood or body fluid smeared somewhere."
"No, there wasn't," Denzel said, vaguely despondent. "We've spent the whole of the last 2 days in this corridor going over the walls and carpet with a photon amp plugged into a lightwear number cruncher, running a spectrographic analysis program. Had to get a special Home Office budget allocation for that. This carpet we're standing on has blotches of wine, gin, whiskey, cleaning detergent, hair, dandruff, skin flakes, shoe rubber, shoe plastic, a lot of cotton thread from jeans. You name it. But no blood. No fluid. Not from Kitchener. Whoever it was, they took a great deal of care not to leave any traces."
"Was Liam Burskin that fastidious?"
Greg asked Vernon.
"I'm not sure," the detective said. "I can check."
"Please,"
Greg said. He loaded a note into his cyberfax.
"What does that matter?" Nevin asked.
"It helps with elimination. I want to know if someone that deranged would bother with being careful. A tech merc would at least make an effort not to leave any marks."
"We do think the murderer wore an apron while he murdered Kitchener," Denzel said. "One of the housekeepers was burnt in the kitchen stove on Friday morning. The students had a salad on Thursday night. So the stove was lit purposely. It was still warm when we arrived. But there are only a few ash flakes left. We know there was blood on the apron, but the residue is so small we couldn't even tell you if it was human blood. It could have come from beef, or rabbit, or sheep."
"The point being, why go to all the trouble of lighting a fire to destroy an apron if it wasn't the one used in the murder?" Vernon said. "You and I know it was the one the murderer used, but in court all it could be is supposition. Any halfway decent brief would tear that argument apart."
"If it was a tech merc, why bother at all?" Eleanor asked. "Why spend all that time fiddling about lighting a fire when they could simply have taken the apron with them? In fact, why use one in the first place?"
"Good point," said Greg.
He seemed troubled.
"Well?" Vernon asked.
"Haven't got a clue."
"Sorry,"
Eleanor said. They shared a smile. Greg looked at the carpet in the corridor, scratching the back of his neck.
"So we do know that the murderer didn't leave by Kitchener's bedroom window," he said. "They went straight down to the kitchen, burnt the apron, then left."
"If he or she left," Vernon said.
"If it was one of the students, then they would have to make very certain no traces of Kitchener left the bedroom, or they would be incriminated," John Nevin said.
There was a touch of malicious enjoyment in his tone. That would fit this cleanliness obsession, the need to avoid contamination.
Contamination. Greg mulled the word over. Yeah. You gave the students a head-to-toe scan, I take it.
As soon as they were back in Orcombe Station, Vernon said. Three of them had touched Kitchener, of course, but only in the presence of the others.
Figures, said Greg. Which three?
Harding Clark, Beswick, and Cameron. But it was only a few stains on their fingertips, entirely consistent with brushing against the body and the sheets.
Okay,
Greg said.
I'd like to see the lightwear cruncher that's been wiped. Is there anything else our murderer tampered with?
Yes, Denzel said. Some of the laboratory equipment. We found it this morning. The computer centre was at the rear of the Abbey, a small windowless room with a bronze-coloured metal door. It slid open as soon as Denzel showed his police identity card to the lock. Bioloom rings came on automatically. Walls and ceiling were all white tiles. The floor had a slick cream-coloured plastic matting. A waist-high desk bench ran all the way round the walls, broken only by the door. There were three elaborate Hitachi terminals sitting on top of it, along with racks of large Memox data store crystals and five reader modules. The Bendix lightwear number cruncher was in the centre of the room, a steel-blue globe 1 meter in diameter, sitting on a pedestal at chest height.
Completely wiped, Denzel said.
He crossed to one of the terminals and touched the power stud. The flat screen lit with the words, Data Load Error. Above the keyboard, a few weak green sparks wriggled through the cube. Kitchener used to store everything in here. All his files, the students' work. He didn't need to make a copy. The holographic memory is supposed to be failsafe.
Even without power, the bytes would remain stable until the actual crystal structure began to break down. 5, 10,000 years. Probably longer. Who knows?
Eleanor looked round the room. There was one conditioning grill set high on a wall. The air was clean, but dead. She couldn't see a blemish anywhere. The tiles and floor were spotless, as were the terminals. "Could the storm have knocked it out?" she asked. Denzel gave her a surprised look.
"Absolutely not. This room is perfectly insulated, and even if the solar panels were struck by lightning, there is a triplicated surge protection system. Besides, a vaulted surge wouldn't cause this." "So what would?"
Greg asked. "There are two things. One, a very sophisticated virus. An internecine, one that wipes itself after it's erased all the files, because there's no trace of it now. Second, someone who knew the core management codes could have ordered a wipe."
"Who knew the codes?"
"I don't know," Vernon said apologetically.
"All right. We'll ask the students when I interview them. What about access to this room? Who is allowed in?"
"Kitchener and the students," said Denzel. "But there are terminals dotted all over the Abbey. You could use any of them to load a virus or order a wipe."
"What about someone outside plugging in?"
"You can only plug into the lightwear cruncher through one of the terminals in the Abbey," Denzel said. "But all the terminals are plugged into English Telecom's datanet, so you have to be inside the Abbey to establish a data link between the Bendix and an external wear system."
"And to get inside the Abbey, you have to be cleared by the security system," Greg murmured. "Neat."
He turned to Vernon Langley.
"English Telecom should be able to provide you with an itemized log for the datanet. Check through it and see if there were any unexplained data links established on Thursday night or Friday morning."
"If it was a Tech-Merc operation, it was the best," Denzel said soberly.
"The very best."
The laboratory was virtually a caricature, Eleanor thought. Either that or set designers on Channel science fiction shows did more research than she had ever given them credit for. But it was a chemistry lab, not a physics one. The room was spacious, with a high ceiling, and the usual ornate mullioned windows, which helped to give it the Frankenstein feel. Tall glass-fronted cabinets were lined up along the walls. Three long wooden benches were spaced down the centre of the room. Each of them had a vast array of glassware on top, immensely complicated crystalline intestines of some adventuresome beast, plastic hardware units clamped around tubes and flasks, a spaghetti tangle of wiring and optical cable winding through it all. Small Ericsson terminals, augmented with customized control modules, were regulating each of the setups. Denzel led them to the middle bench.
"Take a look at this."
He was indicating one section of the glassware, spiral tubing and retorts surrounding what reminded Eleanor of an incubator.
"We found it yesterday when we started classifying the equipment."
He shot a wily look at Vernon Langley.
"Recognize it?"
The detective shook his head.
"It's a syntho vat. High-quality stuff, too. Well above what you'd find on the street. This formula is similar to Naiad."
"Were the students on it?" Greg asked.
"Three of them were using it on Thursday night," Vernon said. "We took blood samples as soon as they came into the station. Harding Clark, Spalvis, and Cameron. But the count was low. They're not addicts."
He sighed.
"Students, experience in life. It's a thrill for them, a little taste of adventure. I imagine bright sparks of that age could get bored very easily with this place."
Eleanor thought he pronounced students with well-emphasized contempt.
"And the other three?" Greg prompted.
"Clean as newborns," John Nevin said. "Of course, all six of them had been drinking. They had wine at their evening meal, and then some more in their rooms later on."
"But not enough to unhinge them?"
"No."
"Kitchener was taking the syntho as well," Vernon said. "It was in the pathology report. Expanding his mind, no doubt. Some such nonsense. He was always on about that, his new thought ideology."
Greg exhaled loudly.
"At his age, Christ."
"And he encouraged the students," John Nevin said disapprovingly.
"Yeah."
"And this," Denzel said theatrically, "is something we found this morning."
He rapped at another chunk of the glassware on the third bench. It had more hardware units than the rest.
"You ought to know what this is, Greg. There's a smaller version in your head."
"Neurohormone synthesizer."
"Well done. Themed neurohormones, to be precise. Makes your blanket inducement look old-fashioned."
"Kitchener was using neurohormones?"
Greg asked in surprise.
"Psi stimulants?"
"Yes," said Vernon. "Quite heavily, as far as we can determine. It's all in the pathology report."
"What sort of psi themes?" Eleanor asked.
"I can't be as helpful there as I'd like," Denzel said. "There is a low-temperature storage vault full of themed ESP educer ampules. But those are a standard commercial type from ICI. He was a regular customer, apparently. However, there's also a small batch of unmarked ampules, which I'll send off for analysis, although we may have problems with identifying it, especially if it's something experimental. We don't have a large database on the stuff. As far as I know, this is the first time it's ever cropped up in a police investigation."
"We may be able to help you there," Greg said. "I'll find out if Event Horizon has any information on neurohormones."
"Fine."
"Do you know what he was using the ESP theme neurohormone for?"
"Apparently it was part of his research, according to the students," Vernon said. "He wanted to perceive electrons and protons directly."
"Get a meeting with Ranasvari set up," Greg told Eleanor. "I want to know if there's any connection between these neurohormones and the research work Kitchener was doing for Event Horizon."
"Right." She flipped open her cyberfax.
"You will inform us, won't you?" Vernon said.
"Yeah,"
Greg growled back. He tried not to flinch at the stab of animosity. Eleanor diplomatically busied herself with the cyberfax file. That good old Mindstar reputation again. Greg ran a forefinger along a module on the top of the neurohormone synthesizer.
"Is this the stuff in the unmarked ampules?"
"No idea," Denzel replied. "It would be the obvious conclusion, but the controlware has been wiped clean, just like the Bendix. There's no record of the formula they were producing."
He pointed at the dark grey plastic casing of the hardware modules, which were integrated into the refining structure. "These units contained endocrine bioware. Very complex, very delicate. They are dead now."
"How?"
"Somebody poisoned them.
They infused a dose of syntho into the cells. It was all quite deliberate."
"The murder was tied in with his work,"
Greg said quietly.
"If this was his work, then yes."